Is that good?
Yo, welcome everybody to another edition of DBI Live. Shout out to Apple, FetLife, Mega Ever Radio. Yo, we got her in the house today. Live and direct from Philadelphia. If this is not going to be the last time, she will be here constantly all the way to election. We have to make sure Philadelphia, the world, that we get her in office. She don't need no introduction, but she's here. I'm going to let her introduce herself because I know I'm not going to do her no justice.
Suave, thank you for that wonderful intro so I can say hello, audience. My name is Kier Bradford Gray, and I can't wait to talk about a lot of different things, but just to get cut to the chase, to the bottom line, I am going to be looking to run, or I am running, for Attorney General of Pennsylvania, and let's talk about what's going on and why. Why would I want to even complicate my life to do something like this?
Why not?
Yeah. Well, you want
to
start
why
with that?
Why not? You know, to us, the audience, one of the things we want to know is, why now?
Yeah. So, you know, when I was younger, I always had a passion to make sure that people like myself, when I say people like myself, young kids who saw two parents working hard but still struggling to give me the things that they thought I should have, I never wanted my children to feel like that. I never wanted my children to feel like there was no one to push them into a world that was beyond what people made them think they can, where they think they can go. And as a young girl, I had always had dreams and goals to do some big things for people, to make sure that people just had a fair shot. I watched my dad not really get the value that he was supposed to get back from the world that he worked so hard for. And I watched my mom, when she got fired from her job with her African-American coworkers, really struggle to make ends meet. And I said to myself, who protects them? And so the law, when I was looking at what I want to do, and I wanted to become a lawyer, right? We didn't know any lawyers. I wanted to be a lawyer. I told a teacher of mine that I wanted to be a lawyer, and she laughed at me. She kind of chuckled and steered me back into being something that she thought I could be. And I never spoke about it again until I left Boston and went to Georgia, and I met my first African-American teacher who was a lawyer. And I went up to her, and she planted seeds and fed into me like no other. And, you know, we can talk about all those steps that it took to me to get to where I am now. But I just say, when I know what little people, what young people need, that encouragement, that understanding, someone to see them, those who feel invisible, to feel less visible because someone can notice what's going on, that is what brings me to the moment when I say, hey, there's a role that's opening up that can actually interpret social issues and push policy that actually helps to protect all people, not just some, but all people, and that's the role of the Attorney General. I never really figured that I'd be here running for a political office, but that office is so amazing. There's no office like it in the country that can do so many things that impact our everyday lives. And so this is why, I mean, summationally, this is why I say my life experiences, my understanding and awareness of where I fit into the world and how the world viewed me, how the world held me back, how the world saw me or didn't see me, those are the things that I want, the perspectives I want to bring to a role that has resources to reach all communities.
So, for the people that don't know you,
yeah,
how long have you been in the public eye?
Public eye? That's a question. Like, because sometimes
I mean,
because
we know you as we know you as the person that was in the public defender's office.
Yeah.
Defending countless of people,
yeah,
that needed representation.
Yeah.
But there's also been some controversy cases.
Oh yeah.
That you have taken on and won.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that a lot of people across the country don't get to see what's happening in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. All we see is the violence. We see the negative. The positive is that we see people that look like us in office, mm-hmm, and you was one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, tell us about that. Like, what was it like being in the public defender's office and now taking a role like I'm running for attorney general?
Yeah.
Do you fear sometimes that some of the people you defended might end up back decide where you and your new role as Attorney General?
I don't think I really think about it that way, right? Because I think if I did my job well, they have been much better off by my representation. So I really do think and hope and pray for everyone that I've represented that they got the things that they needed to build upon what they need to never come back. And the system learned their lesson if they brought them in here wrongfully because they had someone that was going to call them out, me. But I'll say this. I was a public defender long before people knew I was a public defender, right? I was a public defender for 13 years, and I was doing my work in those courtrooms fighting for people. No lights, no cameras, no actions, no crowd of supporters. But I was fighting the fight alone with my client who sometimes didn't even have their families there to back them or be with them. And so those are the things that I was before I became the chief, right? I was winning cases on behalf of my clients because I knew when to push back on the government and say, not this time. I see this person, you don't, but I'm gonna show you who this person is through me. I was kind of, you know, they always talk about the justice system being a David and Goliath type of thing. And I wasn't David, I was the weapon David used to defeat Goliath. And all the time that I was there, use me as your weapon. Use me as your mouthpiece. Because I know what they need. And I know what you are. And I know how to bring the panoramic view together so that people can't confront their own biases, right? Or they have to confront their own biases and say, wow, I never looked at the fact that I'm not applying the law fairly to this person because I'm already judging them as someone who needs to be punished. I fought that all in my entire career up until I got the chance to be the chief where I had the green light to say how this model of service was going to be delivered. And when I say that, as a public defender, when I was in the defender office, I just thought my only goal was put my head down, go into court, and battle it out in court, right? But there's threats that attack my clients all over the place. It's not just in the courtroom. It's in the policies. It's in the narratives. It's in the people who want to keep status quo. It's in the powerful. It's in all of those things. It's in the community who doesn't understand how if they supported what we were able to do or if they pushed back on people who were supposed to do their job and didn't, you had the power to make that public defender office what you needed it to be. So when I was at the federal office, the federal defender in Delaware, that's when I got to realize, wow, you know what? There's something to having a person with my vantage point, my life experience, bringing it into this courtroom for people that I understand that others would write off. And I was winning a record number of cases in the federal office. I got this, SWAT team told me, you're never going to win. We don't go to trial here. I'm looking at these cases, I'm like, I don't know why, because I see beyond these words. People don't do stuff like this. And it's interesting to have someone who understands streets, who was, you know, whose dad was very street savvy, because you know what's real, you know what's not. Bringing that into those areas showed me a lot. But when I got the chance at being a leader, I said, wait a minute, we're doing this service delivery, but people need more. We need to bring the community into our system, into our model, and have them give us feedback on where we're missing the mark.
So how will you bring the community into the Attorney General's office? Because most of the time we view the Attorney General's office as the enemy,
Wow.
Especially my community.
I don't think they know what the Attorney General's office is.
We don't. I do, but I don't think people in my community don't, because the way we see it is like they cops.
No, it's
they cops. And the mentality is it's us against them. So how would you bring an understanding of the office to our community?
So this is what we're doing and hope to do through this campaign, right? Really broaden the understanding of what the role of the Attorney General is. And let's just talk about really quickly how I bring community into it. I want to make sure that I do the same thing that the hallmark of my leadership has been. I created community justice hubs so that people will actually be empowered to understand the levers of their power and how they can use it and infuse it with the legal process so we can get the best outcomes. That's happening today. I brought in community to be on the front end of the system so that we have alternatives to this cash bail mess we've been talking about. You know, we can't wait on the legislator to save us. Let's go to our untapped resource, which is community. They have more solutions to their own problems than we give them credit for. And if we don't bring them in, we'll never know what we could be. So the Attorney General's role, let's talk about that. This is why I want it. It's been generally narrated as a top cop. Wrong word, wrong phrase, right? Wrong moniker. It is the people's lawyer. When you look at it through the lens of every other attorney general that has really amplified why this role is something that you can use for good for people, for protection of people. So let's break it down. The role of the attorney general's role in resources, 13% of that is criminal. 87% of that is protection from everyday people, everyday working class people, and people that definitely, you know, immigrants, whatever they are, making sure that anyone who does business in our Commonwealth, whether you're government or whether you're private business, that you cannot discriminate against people so that you bar their opportunities, that you cannot harm people, making profits over people, and that you cannot deny access to basic opportunities that allow people to thrive, not just survive. How, you ask? Thanks for asking. How you do that? Let's take a few examples. When we're talking about something, I have a pillar, economic justice. This is something that the Attorney General's office has a lot of tools to deal with. What is within economic justice? Well, a whole gamut of stuff. In order for us to have communities that thrive, we need to generate generational wealth, right? So if we get denied from banks to either keep or buy a home, then we don't have stability in our own neighborhoods that allows us to pass on to our children, or that allows us to use those equities within homes, because home ownership is wealth, to educate our children further, to make sure our children have a place to sleep, a place to eat, and a place to be stable, because that's what it takes in order to really have true public safety. And the Attorney General's office will go after banks for modern-day redlining, like it did recently. They sued Trident Bank for discrimination of people in North Philly, where they were denying them loans and mortgages, and when they sued them, they got $20 million back that goes back to those people who were denied, so now they have the down payment on the mortgage that they need to buy their home. They denied people access to wealth to improve their homes. So some of their homes weren't habitable, they couldn't pull equity out of it. And people don't think these things matter. But when people are stealing your home and you don't get nothing but kicked out, this is where the Attorney General ignites. So things that are business practices, that are people that are more powerful, sophisticated, well-resourced, and somebody says, I'm pretty sure I got screwed over, but I don't know how. I don't know how to fight back. Who do you turn to? The Attorney General. Housing, if you care about housing, stability in housing, predatory practices, you should care about the role of the Attorney General. If you care about the mental health of our children, not just in the communities, but behind the walls, you should care about the role of the Attorney General. If you care about our education funding formulas, as someone who's gonna push for more constitutional mandates and making sure our educational systems are properly funded, you should care about the role of the Attorney General. If you care about an even-handed criminal justice response to different communities where the Attorney General can go in and investigate police departments for practices and patterns of discrimination, you should care about the role of the Attorney General. The role of the Attorney General is just that, general. It allows a person like myself to look at practices from institutional behaviors to private practices and say, where are you screwing people over? Where are you harming people? And where are you not providing access? And I'm gonna force you to do right by people. That's the Attorney General role. That's the people's lawyer.
So let's backtrack. What does criminal justice reform look like from an Attorney General's perspective?
Criminal justice reform looks like looking at the response of protection and service to different communities. So if you have gun violence in your neighborhood, right? And I don't solve any of those cases for you. I solve maybe 5%. And there are victims left without justice. The Attorney General can say, why is it that in North Philadelphia, these cases are unsolved and unresolved? Are you not putting the resources and energy and effort into it that you need to be more responsive to the needs of these communities? If you are going in, and like I think it was where the travesty that just happened. I don't know if it was Minneapolis. I'm blanking on the name of the city where we just saw that man get beaten up by the Scorpion unit. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
It's the Attorney General that came in and did an investigation into patterns and practices of that police department to make sure that you're not treating communities of color you're not harming communities of color under the guise of public safety. That word, that phrase, patterns and practices, is a way that the Attorney General can launch investigations when they're getting complaints that either government actors, meaning it could be prisons behind the walls, meaning if they're treating people inhumanely, the Attorney General can go in, launch an investigation. If it's police departments that are going in, just violating people's rights, treating them unfairly, putting wrongful cases on them, it's the Attorney General that goes in and investigates those patterns and practices and says, I want a consent decree. You're going to do better by people's constitutional rights. It is the Attorney General that investigates prisons that have constantly not given people what they deserve in terms of being a human being. Whether they're behind the walls or not, you've got to treat them like a human being and make sure their safety is there.
So whose role is it to investigate some of these organizations in the city of Philadelphia, people, the city of brotherly love, that moonlight as reentry organizations, but are nothing but referral organizations? Because I deal with a program, we sitting right now in the main program at CCP that deal with nothing but returning citizens. I got people that serve 2 years, 3 months, to people that have served 47 years. And the reason they come here is because everywhere they go, they get turned away, or they've been given the runaround. You go to this organization, well, we don't provide that service. You got to go to the next. By the time they get to the third organization, they're done.
Yeah.
They're done. And I found, as a returning citizen myself, that the reentry system in Philadelphia is a joke. I think they need to be investigated. I think that some of their grant money needs to be withdrawn and given to people that really provide the services. Mm-hmm. It's a joke. Mm-hmm. You know, I monitored 100 students, and they all been affected by the system. And not one of them has anything nice to say about a list of organizations in the city that deal with returning citizens, right? And I think that that's crazy because we serve our time. I serve every little bit of time they ask me. 31 years for a crime I didn't commit. They asked me to do 31. I did 31. I had life. Right? I come home. I couldn't find a place. Well, you don't have a good back credit check. Of course, I've been in jail for 31 years since I was 17. Well, we can't rent to you because you don't have good credit. You don't qualify for this job because you have a felony. You know, I was hired by an organization as a case manager. Quit another job just to come work here. 2 weeks later, they sent me a letter. Well, after checking your background, we can't hire you. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm like, what? My first job coming home was working at the 25th Police District. So I know your organization is BSing because I went through the background check. But that is a constant thing that's happening in the city. Whose role is it for someone that's coming home, served 47 years, you know, they don't know who do they report to? Like, this is going on because a lot of time this information don't get to the Attorney General's office because
We don't know how to do it. Well,
so
let's talk about it, because that's exactly what I want to do. Work with communities to help them understand what you need to do to get these issues in front of a person that has the ability to look into it, right? And when you look at the Attorney General's office, who files the complaints? It's people filing complaints for robocalls. It's people filing complaints for people who defraud them as they're fixing up their homes. So, like, homes that do roofs repairs and they don't do a good job. Certain people know how to get their issues in front of the Attorney General. And let's break down what you just said. The Attorney General can do two things. One, it can investigate. It can also advance policy because they have an understanding and wherewithal to interpret social issues, raise it to a platform, and talk about public policy that's for the good of all of us. So, restoration. That's in the Attorney General purview. The Attorney General, one, has a seat on the Board of Pardons. So has a vote on who gets pardoned and who doesn't, right? So that's number one. That's a direct correlation for restoration.
A very important vote, ladies and gentlemen.
Very important, because you know it's a majority when you get to a certain level. Two, the Attorney General can also oversee nonprofits and their dealings. Are they delivering their mission? Are they straying for the mission? Are they using their money to actually reach the people they're getting? Are they paying their board of directors and their CEOs far more and in excess that they should be? This is what the Attorney General's office does, is looks at and oversees any nonprofits to make sure that their nonprofit agency is doing the things that they have filed in their mission, in their articles and bylaws. And if there's word that these nonprofits are not, that they're misappropriating money, this is where the Attorney General comes in, launches an investigation, and files lawsuits, or revokes your, or recommends to revoke your status as a nonprofit agency. But we'll get back to restoration. There are 930-something legislative acts. I say 30-something because there are probably more than 930-something now. But the last time I checked, there were 937 legislative acts that exclude people with convictions from qualities of life across the Commonwealth. This is almost 1,000 legislative acts that excludes you from so many areas of life that makes you become a second-class citizen even after you believe you served your time. You are not even treated fairly by the system, because while you may, and there's some people that are involved in something but not involved in what they got, and then there's some people that just didn't do it. And unfortunately, because of the way the system is set up, their lack of strength in fighting against it, they had to make the tough decisions to mitigate their damage. And I know these things by working on that side and working with people and pushing the system to be better. But I do know this. Unions want people who have the ability to work without being encumbered that if we work on this school project, you can't because you have this record. So we got to do better, a better job at restoration. All this expunger stuff that only expunges things that are non-conviction, we need more of an avenue to make sure that people who have restored themselves and they have demonstrated restoration, that we give them that opportunity. This pardon process needs to be broadened. It needs to be more understood. It needs to be streamlined. And I know the former Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman tried to do that, but he was alone. If he had a AG like me at the time, we could have done these things. And we got a new Lieutenant Governor, Austin Davis, who I'm very optimistic about in terms of him understanding the nuances.
A lot of people are.
Good. Because I would love to work with him in that area. And it's Lieutenant Governor and the AG that also sits on the Board of Pardons and looks at what's coming through the pipeline and should we advance better policy in this area that allows people to have a fighting chance.
You know, well, you probably know my story, but I came home and I was introduced to new technology, which is a phone. But when I was in prison, I wasn't even allowed to be next to a computer because I was a lifer. So I came home and discovered that this could be an introduction to the world for me. And I created a podcast. And I just wanted to tell my story. Next thing you know, we won a Pulitzer Prize.
We won an
Ideator Award, which is like the Oscar in podcast. And I'm thinking, like, what the heck is this? I didn't even know what it was. But then I start getting the Pulitzer Prize was getting complaints from people from our great city. You know, like, why is y'all giving a Pulitzer Prize to a formerly incarcerated? And some politicians.
That's a shame.
Some politicians. And I'm like, ain't this what a second chance supposed to look like? Where we come home, give back, and do wonderful things to help other people stay
Absolutely.
Out of prison. You know, that's what I thought it was. But instead, I got, why is we giving a Pulitzer Prize to a formerly incarcerated?
That's a
shame. And, you know, to me, I could have just take that and say, you know what, I'm not going to get away. I took that and said, you know what, I'm taking this all away. Because I believe that when you give people a second chance, this is what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I went to prison with a 56 IQ. The only thing I could spell was my name, and I did that wrong. It was recently that they fixed my name, because I was spelling it wrong all my whole life. But I educated myself, got my degrees, went to Villanova, you know, and to the point where they just nominated me for a PhD, right? But to me, it still don't mean nothing. It don't mean nothing because if we don't have people like you in office, they could see the potential in other people and get them the other chance. It's just be, oh, well, that was just one. You know, I don't want Suave to be the only one to win a Pulitzer Prize. They created a category for audio reporting because of my story. So that means the door is open for the next person.
That's exactly
but if we don't give the next person a chance, then it just be one. You know, so what I'm asking you is, as Attorney General, you know, will you look deep into cases that come in front of you? Because sometimes, you know, a lot of people do stuff when they're young, but as they grow old in prison, you know, they have remorse. Like I said, I went to prison for something I didn't do, but I still accept responsibility for everything that happened in my life.
Sure.
Because I was living a life that wasn't conducive to my community. I didn't do that, but I was doing other things.
Right.
You know, so I just wish that we have more people like you in office, more people that understand what really going on in North Philly in the Badlands, instead of just, I'm going to just read what's in the file and know.
You know what? I think, Suave, you hit the nail on the head. First of all, you said a lot, so I'm trying to, like, really compartmentalize my thoughts here because you touched on a lot of points. One of the things that people have to understand is my office resentenced the juvenile lifers.
Yes.
We watched and got close and personal to the stories of these folks and saw the victimizations of them as children that were never given therapy. They were never addressed. Some of the things they went through, we also represent children that were abused and neglected, right? Some of the abuses, some of the neglect, some of the terrible things that they were told from the very young age that stuck with them. Some of the things that they endured that some of these parents and people who are decision makers could never understand. Walking out your house hungry, not even knowing where your parents are. Are they even home in the morning when I gotta go to school? Do I have clean clothes to wear when I go to school? Do I have the confidence in me to respect myself so that I respect others? All of these things are disinvestments, and some of these systems are quite aware of what it will take to restore these young children, but won't be willing to put the resources behind it on the front end to do that. It just costs too much. But they'll be willing to put the resources on the back end to lock them up when they succumb to all the things that they've endured. Children don't come into this world thinking that they want to go into a life of crime. That happens, right? Sure, there are people that are opportunists and that are greedy. I'm not going to deny that they're not that going on. That's very far and few between of what I saw. I saw people who were mostly misguided. Yes, there were a small percentage of people that I'm like, listen, dude, you just need to sit your behind down because you are doing some stuff that you're never going to help other people pay it forward. That's not the vast majority of people that are in here. And even those folks, obviously, they got something with them that has happened to them that they can't articulate or probably have pushed so back far in their mind that they don't even know what makes them tick. But we saw a restoration and redemption, not just in people who were charged as juvenile lifers that were coming out now as senior citizens, but in the families of the victims who have said in those hearings, I forgive you, I believe you, and I have moved on, and I understand you're not that same person. These are people that are no longer, they don't want to wear the victim cloak. They are survivors. They are people that have overcome their grief, and they understand the circumstances of the world created this. And I don't want to sound idealistic and optimistic, but we do understand that people have choice, but there are some people that succumb to the negative things that they have always been fed. And we got to make sure that we get those moments when we can and make sure that we say, hey, I saw you coming in 2 years old with broken bones, sexually abused, and if I only give you something for 3 years and not follow what you need, what are you going to think? When are those trauma triggers going to seep in when you're not getting the care and concern from the world that you think you should get? That same feeling of worthlessness is going to fester. Those are real things. I'm not saying it's an excuse, But it's real. And if we don't start looking at ways to deal with that early on and stop acting like we're going to deal with it on the back end, then we're always going to be losing. So in order to change the circumstance, we need to change the conversation. We really do. And what does government need to be responsive to? How does it need to be responsive? Sure, there's a deterrence on the back end, but there's certain things, investments that kids need that these systems see it, but don't want to put things in it. Think about this. The unfortunate situation in Sandy Hook where those kids were murdered. Everybody recognized right away that the kids who survived were going to need long-term therapy, right? I didn't hear that for kids who see violence and death every day. I don't hear the funding stream for long-term therapy for them when that happens. But we know in order for kids to be healthy and grow, they've got to be able to mature out of these things that they've seen in these negative images so they can be normalized. But those same types of, I guess, the things that make people say, hey, we want to make sure that this kid has a fighting chance, I don't see that for some of these other children. And we got to be able to apply the same care and concern to children. I don't care who they think you are, what parents you were raised to, every child has different potential. And we got to tap into that. And if it wasn't tapped in for me, because it wasn't in the beginning, my mom and dad were amazing. I love them. They had their own, you know, issues. Of course, I was the first one to go to college in my household, and they were so proud of me. My dad, when he wasn't given the treatment that he needed through the healthcare systems, when he needed them, he was a Boston Water and Sewer worker, right? So he had constantly torn rotator cuffs, lifting those heavy pipes, going to work injured, going to the doctors and saying, complaining about his injury, they wouldn't take him out of work. They wouldn't give him a reason to heal. They wouldn't give him anything to heal, right? They sent him home with some Advil, but then sent us a $400 bill in the mail. You gave him nothing as a service, but you kind of robbed us because he had to come in to see you. You saw him for 20 minutes, and that was $400? Who fights for those folks to get what they're supposed to get, to make sure that you send that complaint to the right person who can start looking at the quality of care and the type of bill that you're receiving based on the quality of care? My father did not go back to the doctors for his issues. Instead, he self-medicated those things. And that self-medicating, he succumbed to those issues. But our family was thrown into this cycle because people didn't take the care and concern enough for their roles to value every human being, to make sure that this guy who was working hard every day was able to heal, go back to work healthily, and not have to go to work feeling like nobody gave a damn about him. That was a long-winded answer, but it did come through and tell you, like, I see life through a perspective that not a lot of people do, and I get how it's connected to all the other things.
I mean, when I see you and I hear you and I follow your work for years, you know, I used to be in Gratisville prison, and we all used to say, damn, we wish we had a lawyer like her. Mm-hmm. We used to say that. And because the way you care for your clients. But now that I'm here on the other side, I'm no longer in prison. You know, people look at me like you're a regular citizen, which I am.
Yeah.
So when I'm walking down the streets, when I'm walking down Huntington Park, and I see the violence, I ask myself, what's going on? Why is this happening in this community? You know, as Attorney General, what is the role of the Attorney General in the violence in the city of Philadelphia right now?
Yes.
Because we get in a bad rap national news. Everywhere I go, I was just in Portland, and there was like, Philadelphia is just killing. I'm like, where'd you get that from? You know, because it's just what they see. It's the little videos they see on TikTok.
Yeah.
What is the role of the Attorney General with all the violence that's going on in the city?
Yeah.
And has it skyrocketed, or is it still the same from the last 3 years? What's going on? Because a lot of people don't know these numbers. Yeah. We just go by what we see in the news 30 seconds and we run with it.
Yeah. So let's just start with this. The role of the Attorney General is to be a partner in advancing public safety. And public safety is not just a law enforcement lens, like I said. Public safety is making sure people have those stabilities so that they're not in the streets. Start there. And so we want to raise awareness and consciousness that there's opportunity for that. But just talking about gun violence, right? When I moved to Philadelphia in the 90s, they used to call it Killadelphia, right? Yes. And at that time, there was a strict DA, a no-nonsense war on crime DA, and everyone else who was law and order, but we still had a heavy murder rate. So it has to be something more than just some of the actors in the system. Fast forward to now, we had a lull about, you know, we allowed that Killadelphia stuff to let us lock everybody up, lock them all up. But we had to realize people coming back.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. You know, in the 90s, we did have the deadliest DA. We all know who that is, people. I'm not going to mention her name yet.
And we had a high murder rate.
Because we have a good story for her soon dropping. However, what we saw in her administration is being undone now.
I was a public defender.
So what I'm saying, people, for those of y'all, I'll be straight up. We saw a lot of wrongful convictions.
Oh yeah.
So my question to you is, as Attorney General, do you think the District Attorney's office in Philadelphia should be blamed for all the violence that's going on in the community and for looking into the past convictions where we now see that 20, almost 30 people has been released because of wrongful convictions? Do you think they should be to blame?
All right, I want to compartmentalize these questions because I wanted to make sure I talked about the role of the Attorney General in gun violence really quickly.
Okay.
So the Attorney General looks at institutional behavior, right? There's a lot of people that's getting away with their share of the gun violence. The clients that I represented, they didn't make the guns. They didn't have 3D printers. There were people that could legally get guns that were distributing it unlawfully throughout our cities because they know they can get quick dollars. Profits over people. There are gun shop owners that are turning a blind eye to people who shouldn't have these guns coming in and trafficking. They need to be held accountable for their parts. There are business practices that allow for free enterprise of guns to be shuffled through our communities with no problem. The Attorney General is the one that makes sure that those people are held accountable. You want to talk about Johnny on the corner? Well, how did Johnny get that gun? Johnny didn't make the gun. Johnny can't go in the store and buy the gun. So how is Johnny getting the guns? And those are the people, the suppliers, they want us to mop the floor instead of fixing the leak. I want to fix the leak. And I want to do it in partnership with whoever's doing stuff on the ground to help these kids not want to pick up that weapon. But these weapons are so attractive, right? Very attractive. And the people who do business know that. So they flood the market, flood the market, flood the market. And when you flood the market with weapons, yeah, there's going to be unlikely businesses that pop up that's going to distribute these guns no matter what. When the PPP money was out, guns was like candy, right? Because, oh, you got cash? Oh, all right. I got a duffel bag full of stuff. Where are these understandings and long-term investigations to go after the bigger fish that are coming from New York, trafficking guns, that are leaving Pennsylvania, going to New York, trafficking guns? Where are the common sense gun laws that just say, check people, right? We should not have situations where people can buy a gun online and I don't have to see your face or know who you are. I can be a 14-year-old ordering that online. But this is what's allowed. And we're sitting there accepting this, oh, because of the Second Amendment, because of the Second Amendment, all while the Fourth Amendment is nothing, right? We don't have a Fourth Amendment when it comes to gun violence, but the Second Amendment stands strong. So I'm going to make sure that I protect all people's constitutional rights, but by doing that, you got to make sure the people that are eroding it are held accountable. So that's the role the Attorney General will play in that. I'm not going to just look at Johnny. I'm going to look at how Johnny got that. But two, what you said, should the DA's office be blamed for the gun violence? That is so short-sighted. And so, I think, shows lack of leadership, right? If you just look at a DA and say it's his fault. Now, gun violence is down by 38% right now. Is it the DA's fault? Is it the DA's accolade that gun violence is down? No. What we really need to look at is what have we been doing differently? And what we've been doing is we've been investing in people that are on the ground by giving them the basic infrastructure so they can take in these people that they need to, give them pro-social activities, connect them to jobs and other resources, but the only way we're going to get to them is by using the people who are in those communities. Government can't do that. And I'm glad they finally realized that, so they structure these small mom-and-pop nonprofits who are really more so like service-minded, service-oriented. They may not be administratively structured, but give them some of that administrative resource. If I get a grant, give them someone who can report on the grant. Give them someone who can write the grant, right? These folks, they ain't doing all that. They're doing the hard work. I'm gonna go in your house. I'm gonna make sure I stay in your face. I wanna make sure I stay on your back. I wanna make sure people understand you. I wanna make sure I can get out of you what I need to get out of you so I can help you. That's a full-time job. So give them the other stuff. That's what's working right now. And that's not getting the conversation or the credit that it deserves and that it needs, because when you do the right thing, when you have leadership and you use the resources to get to the heart of the matter, things start changing. And so we heard all this time, oh, gun violence is up, it's Larry. That's such short-sighted narrative that we need to stop right now, and we need to call out any politician that wants to just make that correlation, because guess what? Only 20% of the shootings are touching our systems. So how can it be Larry? If people aren't being caught, how can it be Larry?
You know, I say this. I live in a pretty hot zone. I live in Huntington
Park.
Your
block is hot. Your block
is
hot.
My block is hot in Huntington Park, but I feel safe. I feel safe because the people in my neighborhood know who I am. They know what I'm into. You know, and out of respect, when I come through, you know, they and they tell me, like, yo, the reason we out here is because nobody will hire us.
Yeah.
Nobody give us a chance, right? And you know, and you hear that over and over and over again. You know, I was locked up. Nobody wanted to give me a chance, so I got to hustle. I got 3 kids. And I always wonder, like, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing wrong that I blessed with opportunities that these other persons should have? And I think that for me, it's almost like I know how to network with people.
Yeah.
I learned that in prison. I know how to network with people. I'm not afraid to create my own. You know, when they told me, a city radio station told me, you never gonna be nothing, you can't do podcasts. I went and created my own media company.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not only in Philly, but I got an office in New York and I got an office in San Francisco. Staff. Like, I actually have a staff. I don't know what that means, but I actually got a staff. Producers, engineers, right?
That means you got support.
And I tell people this. I didn't get there by myself.
That's right.
I didn't get there by myself. I got there because people gave me an opportunity. But I don't see that in Philadelphia. I really don't. I see politicians that come into our neighborhoods when they want pictures. You know, that's why I refuse to be in the presence of certain politicians. Oh, we need you to come out. You can be the face. No, I don't want to be the face of nothing, right? I choose who I want to mess with. Because I just feel like, man, we had hundreds and hundreds of people returning to Philadelphia from prison.
Yeah.
They are probably going back. Some of them are homeless. When I drive through on front in Allegheny, I see people in their brown state boots and shorts. I'm like, yo, what's up? You just came home? Yeah. Where you stay at? I'm out in the street. A lot of people prefer to max out than be on parole and then instantly become homeless.
Yeah.
And these are the same people we see in the gas station selling the pills. You know, it's easy to say, oh, they're nothing but junkies. We could say that. But the backstory is that we're not doing enough to ensure that that person don't go back.
Right.
You know, so my mission always been, education, education, and opportunities. You know, as Attorney General, what opportunities would you create to ensure that nobody, man or woman, is coming home, hit the street, and be homeless?
So as Attorney General, you can never do something like that alone, but you can advocate and make sure that there are barriers, unnecessary barriers, that are not in place so that people who want and deserve a second chance get that unfettered, right? I mean, there's a person who is going to be running for Attorney General, too. He talks about his father coming out of jail and going from rags to riches and becoming a millionaire. Well, what opportunities and support did that person have? And can we replicate that? Because many of these people coming out of prison have an extremely exquisite minds. They've spent a lot of time just really looking deep down into a lot of things, and they have a lot to offer. But we want to easily narrate them out of society. They can't be trusted. They have this. So breaking down those barriers, meaning getting rid of some of these unnecessary collateral consequences, really working with the business community to make sure that they understand that integrating people into the workforce world is going to be a part of advancing public safety. And if you want people's property values and all these things and your business to boom and people to stay in these communities and build more business, well, help us reduce the likelihood that people feel just strictly in poverty and that they have no stability. Because when you don't have any stability, everything else is secondary. You can't function like that. I don't care how strong you are. You just can't function when you don't have a place to lay your head at, or, you know, place to call your own and home. You cannot function that way. So everyone wants to say, oh, you didn't go do this. You didn't see your PO. You didn't do this. Well, does this man have a place to live? Because we need to start there. And if you're on probation and you don't have that, then somebody's failing you.
Yep.
Somebody's failing you.
Yep.
And so just like Obama, when he levied penalties against hospitals who had a high rate of readmission, meaning like these people kept coming back for the same things, he said there's got to be something about your discharge process that's not getting to the heart of what they need, and so I'm going to levy penalties against you. Well, the criminal justice system is the only system, billion-dollar industry, that we don't levy penalties against when people come back at such high rates. We just call it recidivism. But we don't do anything more to drill down about what that recidivism looks like and where we can alleviate some of those recidivist opportunities, because we're actually giving people some connection. So that's one thing. The platform that the AG has is to bring sensibility to what we want to do. So we have the ability to work with business communities. Stop with your algorithms that just exclude people who have, I don't know, still marijuana convictions on their record, right? Let's stop with those algorithms. If those are what your algorithms are doing, you're really doing a disservice to the workforce, number one. Number two, let's raise some daggone wages so that people know that this is something. If I have one job, I can keep eyes on my children because I don't have to work 2-3 hustles. Be tired, be nervous. If I lose this hustle, I lose my house. I need all these 3 hustles. I can't take the kids to basketball practice. I can't go see their game. I can't go to the parent-teachers conference. I can't do the things that healthy families can do because I'm too busy hustling. And making sure that people have the right training and opportunities. And everything ain't about a college degree. It's making sure that there are the right training and opportunities to get into these roles that allow you to have a good, decent living and a steady and consistent decent living. Learning about AI, learning about all these new waves that are coming in that are going to need people to really start to get into this mechanism. Why are we waiting for forever for people in the prison to catch up to this, right? Why are we waiting? I mean, the Attorney General alone has a platform that they can raise awareness from a real informed perspective, like I have, and start looking at what the collaborations can be to actually make these things connect.
You know, I recently contacted the Attorney General's office because I work with an organization called The Last Mile.
Last Mile?
Yeah.
All right.
And what they do, they go into the prisons and teach people how to coding. And I'm like, bro, every time I meet with them, I'm like, I mean, we could try, but PA is not having that. You know, and for some reason, for a state that has the most lifers, a state that houses the most juvenile lifers, there's nothing inside the prison that prepared the man and woman to come home and be going to the workforce. Nothing. Nothing.
And that's I think that's what the Attorney General should be pushing for.
Yes.
What's behind the walls. Remember I said the Attorney General can look at what's happening behind the walls? Well, if our rate of readmission is high because you're not giving people the tools they need to get out there, then why are we funding you at this level? And why aren't we demanding more of you to make sure? Because it's not hard for prisons to open up the door and let other entities come in and do what they do, right? I mean, of course, it's going to take, you got have to have manpower, make sure people are able to staff areas, but it doesn't cost you a lot for organizations who want to work with people behind the walls and say, I want to teach them this. Let's just, and let's talk about this one too. Many people in county prisons can vote.
Whoa, let me go a little further. Anyone being released from state prison could vote.
Well, that's not even further.
I'm just saying, I just want to let the people know, because I get it every day. Like, I can't vote. I'm like, who told you that?
No.
Who told you that?
You gotta say it like this. Anybody walking on the streets can vote.
Right? Anyone, especially in the state of PA. If you was in prison, I voted. I voted for the first time in 2017 when I came home, because I wasn't even aware that I could register as a voter. Somebody from the city hall told me, you can vote. I voted. And I always tell people, like, if we don't like what we see, register to vote and vote. Voting don't mean just for president. Smart. Municipal elections, city, judges, council people,
Swat.
Attorney generals.
Go a step further. Everybody walking the streets can vote, period. People don't even realize that people sitting in jail can vote.
Yes.
That's the crazy part, right? If let's talk about when you can't vote, because this is the only one thing. I'll give you one way you can't vote. If you're serving a sentence for a felony conviction, that's it. That's the only way you can't vote. So if you're serving a sentence for a misdemeanor, you can vote. If you're sitting in pretrial, you can vote. If you're sitting on a probation detainer for misdemeanor, you can vote. If you're sitting on a probation violation, you can vote. If you're serving a sentence for a criminal a felony conviction, that's the only way you can't vote.
But until you are released in PA.
I said, we started with the premise, everybody walking the streets right. can vote. So we don't even want to confuse people. If your feet are on the concrete, you can vote. All right? So we just put that out there right there. If you're touching the concrete, if you're smelling the air, if you're touching the grass, you can vote.
So with that said, with that, you can vote. How can we, returning citizens, can help you as Attorney General?
Well, first of all, we help get you? There. You can help me get there.
I believe you're going to get there.
Well, let me tell you how.
I got deep faith. I believe you are going to get there. I believe that the city of Philadelphia, and I'm making this call to my brothers and sisters, returning citizens. We need to ensure, please, we need to ensure that she gets in office. How do we do that? We do that by donating.
First and foremost.
No donation is too small. A dollar, $2, $3. Donate. Get involved. We did it with Obama.
Yes.
We did it with Obama. There is a reason why we're doing this interview at Community College. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why. Because I believe that the students here need to hear from you directly. Sometimes we see people on the news, they're not reachable.
Yeah.
You're not one of them.
I know that. Reachable.
She's here. You know, so I'm asking people, if you support me, well, we got millions and millions of people following the Suave podcast. Do the same thing and support care for Attorney General by donating.
How do we donate?
And if this sounds like an endorsement, it is.
Wait.
I mean, and I think that we could do that because I'm not restricted. I'm not bond. We own our own feed. We own our own radio station. We own this. Like, we bossing up. And we are throwing our support behind you because we believe. Mm-hmm. You know, my partner in San Francisco is going all the way out. We pulling all the strings. You know, just because you're in San Francisco, New York, tri-state area, don't mean you can't get involved. We all know somebody in PA. We all know somebody in prison. And we all want somebody to get that 5 votes when they go up for commutation. And we want somebody to sit on that ball, to be fair. Yeah. Even if we don't get the vote, we just want to be fair.
Yeah. Everybody should get a fair shot.
And our next Attorney General will be fair, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
It would be fair.
I want somebody to be fair to me.
And you know what? And you know what? We always talking about, well, these politicians ain't doing nothing, but we got one now. I don't even consider her a politician. I consider her somebody from the community that cares. They care. So my next question to you is,
yes.
Stop and frisk.
Okay.
What is going on? What is going on in Philadelphia that we are getting caught up with? I'm just voting. Let me be clear. Suave Gonzalez do not vote for people just because they look like me, mm-hmm. or just because they talk like, I don't even speak Spanish like that, but people right. think I do. But it's cool. I got a couple of words, right? So what I'm saying, right, stop and frisk. You spoke on constitutional rights. Isn't that a violation of our constitutional rights?
Yeah, so let's break this down.
You know, can you break that down in simple terms with our listeners can understand?
Stop and frisk is not a policy. It's a practice, right? So let's start there. When I say
that again,
stop and frisk is not a policy. Meaning the police department can't be like, oh, go on 13th and Cameron, stop everybody and frisk everybody. That's unconstitutional, right? The practice that allows for stop and frisk to come into play is supposed to be when officers who are doing good officer work, not racially biased work, are watching somebody and interpreting their behaviors as, I think that guy is up to something. So if you look at the first case, which is Terry v. Ohio, that gave the police the ability to stop and frisk, what was happening with Terry? Well, Terry was outside at like 13 degrees below zero, walking around a jewelry store several times for hours, looking very suspicious. Ain't nobody live there. It's a business, right? And the officers are standing there looking at him saying, this dude looks like he's up to something. Why does he look like he's up to something? He's fidgeting with his bag and keep going in it. He's going behind the jewelry store. He's walking around the jewelry store. He's shifting, looking back and forth. This is an area that has, this jewelry store has been broken into a lot of times. They're able to use those facts to say, let me go up to him and see what I can, and stop him, ask him what he's up to. And if I notice something on him that makes me think he had a weapon, I can frisk him. Now, I don't think many people, when it's applied in that way, have a problem with that, right? Because if you see a person casing around my house, I don't want you just ignore it. I want you to say, hey, man, what's up? What you doing here? You live here? And if I see a ball, stop you. That is a practice that police have. Now, it has been abused like no other because what police have done is take the easy way out. I don't like the way he looks. Let me stop and frisk him. He's standing on that corner. I don't know why, but let me stop and frisk him. That's not stop and frisk. You have to articulate the reasons why you think this person is up to something. And I know we've all seen people. You're on the block, it's hot, you're sitting there shaking hands for hours, and people coming up to you doing this. We know what's what, right? Stop and frisk applies to real situations where you can see that something's not right. You may not have to be totally right, but you need to have some real basis to say something don't feel right here based on what I'm seeing. Not because of the person that I'm looking at, but because of the actions that I'm looking at. That's stop and frisk. But when we sit there and tell the police department that they can create a policy, everybody over in this area of the city is going to get stop and frisk. That's unconstitutional because you ain't seen me do nothing to stop and frisk me. You haven't seen me do nothing for you to formulate in your mind that I'm committing a crime or about to commit a crime. So the law allows for what the law interpreted as common sense policing, but all sense ain't common. You may look at me if I have a different clothing on. My husband was in stop and frisk, right? He was in 2019, he was pulled over by the officers. My husband, when he's not in a suit, he wears Tim's and jeans and a baseball cap and all of that. He's pulled over.
Listen, this is real. When I started here, this is how I come to work every day. I had a particular person that used to get in the elevator. And every time, for about 6 months, do you work here? because, you know, and I'm like, no, I don't. I'm just floating around the school. I'm just going to people's classroom. To the point where I had to address it with the top. Like, yo, I just feel discriminated by this person. And I remember getting off the train on Broad Street a day before somebody got assaulted there. The minute I got off the train, got up the steps, I was stopped. And I asked the officer, what's going on?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, you fit the profile. This was a black officer.
The profile?
I said, that's what I said. Profile of what? And it just happened to be that a day that I had the Pulitzer Prize in my backpack. So he said, did you give me consent to search? I said, absolutely not. You got to tell me why is you searching me.
Right.
He said, somebody called, somebody had a hat. I said, a hat?
I'm looking a hat. Not said, a specific hat, but
so,
a hat.
So he said, where you work at? I said, I work at community college. This dude ran my name. He said, oh, you ever been in prison? I said, I played the fifth man. Because now this is interrogation.
Right.
I said, now I do have my lawyer's number. You want my lawyer?
Right.
So they had to call the white shirt.
For what? Though?
And
what did
they held me up in front of that pharmacy for about half hour. And I pull out my phone because I'm in the business of reporting. Just started recording, so the guy said, you can't record. I said,
yes, you can.
You don't know the law in PA, right? I said, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm damn near close, right? And that was the day that I realized that it don't really matter, right, who you are, what you look like. If that person think you did it, you did it. You did it. So when I hear stop and frisk, our next wannabe mayor, you know, my question come up. It's like, who are they stopping? We know they're not stopping rich white folks. Because that day when they stopped me in Broad Street, there was a bunch of white students coming. Coming, they look worse than me. I don't look worse dressing. I just, you know, wear a Yankee hat. I don't wear the suits to come to work. I don't need to. You ain't stopped them, you stopped me. Because I had a backpack and a Yankee hat on. And then you had the audacity to send a black cop, an undercover, like I'm supposed to, yeah, search me. You know, so.
We just have to be clear what stop and frisk is and what it is.
Right, and I don't think people get it.
Here's what they can't do.
But the race, let me be more clear, do race play a part in stop and frisk?
I think you know the answer to that question.
I don't.
So let me say this. Does race, we did a study, my office, we studied 309,000 car stops in 2019. And we wanted to see, because the city has to report everyone they stop, reasons why they stop them, and what was, we call it the hit rate. What did they get out of that stop and search, right? Because that's different than stop and frisk, stop and search. And what we found out of those 309,000 car stops, 72% were for black drivers. 22% for white drivers, and then there was this other category, right? And when they stopped black drivers and they searched black drivers, what they found on them was only about 0.17% of the time that they would find something legal. So it could be a drugs, it could be whatever. 0.17% of the time. That means 99.83% of the time they didn't find anything on anyone they searched as black drivers. When they searched the white drivers, they found something on them at a rate of 4 times higher. So less of a population, they stopped, searched them, and found something more times, 4 times the rate that they did with black drivers. So what did that mean? That mean that these behaviors or these people that you were stopping, one, were otherwise law-abiding citizens. Now you are alienating this community because you are showing them that they are suspicious to you based on doing nothing at all. And two, you're not getting a return on that investment, because if you were stopping people under the real reasons that stop and frisk exists, meaning I'm looking at your actions, I'm seeing what you're doing, I'm interpreting them based on my experience and knowledge that something's not right, right? You're showing us that you don't even know what you're looking for. You're just looking at a profile and you're saying, I wonder if that person has something. That's old school Barney Fife way of doing business. Shake as many people down, you're liable to find something. That's not what stop and frisk was supposed to be. But that's what it's turned into because people don't have the experience, the education, the training to really do the job the way it needs to be done. Because if you did, you wouldn't be going after the easy fruit, right? Oh, nobody cares about this community in North Philly. Let's shake them all down. We'll find something. That's not policing. That's not good policing. That's not what stop and frisk under the law allows. That is what it's turned into, and that is what mayoral candidates across the board allow. Now, there are a lot of tools to look at what's happening with stop and frisk practices, especially here in Philadelphia. You can watch the data like we did. We analyzed the data, and we said your car stop practices, they are racially motivated and racially biased. They are not rooted in public safety, because if they were, you'd find something more often. So don't waste my resources, my taxpayer dollars, and giving me this facade of public safety when you're not doing anything close to that. What you're doing is you're alienating my community, and you need me to solve my crimes in my neighborhood. But if you make me feel like I'm an enemy, I'm not coming to you with information. I'm not working with you to develop witnesses. I'm not even going to come to court and be a witness, and I don't trust none of y'all, right? That's how people feel. And we have not had the person with the depth of understanding enough to say, look, we're not going to just blanketly go into neighborhoods and stop and frisk them. I want to see the data that shows me that when you're making your decisions on who you stop, frisk, and search, that there is actually some return on that investment. Because if not, then what you're doing is you're just doing racial profiling. And I think one thing that people need to understand is that we as black people, we don't like crime. We're not asking for police to turn a blind eye to crime, but we don't want racial profiling. And you can have both. And they make us believe you have to trade one or the other. And it's not true. It's just not true. So when I say stop and frisk, I spend more time dealing with stop and frisk in the courts, and it's the judges that interpret, is this what stop and frisk allows, versus the politicians who get elected. They can't do anything about that other than monitor their police commissioner and say, I want the data from last year's numbers of stop and frisk. I want to understand who's being stopped. Are they African Americans? Are they male or female? Are they in a particular neighborhood? And what was found? And if someone is intentional enough to review that quarterly, see what's going on, and say, you know what, Officer A that patrols 19th and Cambria has stopped 500 people and only found something on two of them. We need to get Officer A some more training. And we need to monitor Officer A because he's not doing the job right. That can happen, but nobody knows how to do that. We did that as defenders, and we gave it to Isaiah Thomas to say, hey, remember you had an issue about driving while black? Well, here's the data. Here's the proof that this is what it really is. And Isaiah, we worked with Isaiah Thomas' staff to create driving equity bill. And that is, you can no longer pull some people over for these minor things that you've used as an excuse to pull them over and then search them and find nothing on them. They're still illegal. Yeah, you can't have one headlight out, but you can't be pulled over for that, right? One out of many, not headlights, sorry. Let me clarify that. You will get pulled over if you have a headlight out. Taillights. Some of these cars are made with like 3, 4, 5, 6 taillights. If one out of 5 taillights is out, you're not supposed to be pulled over for that alone. You can still get a ticket for that, but pulled over is different, like the seatbelt law. Remember when they were used to allow people to pull you over for the seatbelt law? Well, that became the routine thing. Oh, pull them over for no seatbelts, pull them over for no seatbelt. Well, they stopped that. You can no longer pull people over for no seatbelt, but if you get pulled over for something else that you did that's legitimate and you have no seatbelt, you can still get a ticket. Those are things that we use to alleviate the way the officers are using some of these things to say, I got to pull this person over. That doesn't mean people aren't going to get pulled over for stuff they do in their cars. If you got dark casket tinted windows, you're still going to be pulled over because that's illegal. If you're blowing stop signs, you're going to be pulled over. If you're speeding, you're going to be pulled over. If your tags are non-existent, you're going to be pulled over. If your tags come up stolen, you're going to be pulled over. It's still common sense things that you're going to be pulled over for to deter crime. But we're not just going to give you the excuse to easily pull us over for minor things just to search us and find nothing and have us tied up for hours sometimes because you think think that I'm suspicious. That has to stop.
My name is Suave Gonzalez, and I'll approve this message. And you know what else, people? Please do not forget to donate and donate and donate some more. CareAG.com.
I'll say it.
Please. I'm probably saying it wrong because I ain't got my glasses.
How can you donate? You can donate by going to Keir, K-E-I-R, 4-F-O-R-A-G.com.
You know, people, I'm blind. Y'all know that, so if I ain't got my glasses, I can't really see.
Keir4AG.com. Four, yes, is spelled out F-O-R. Keir, K-E-I-R, 4-F-O-R-A-G.com.
And you know what else, people? You know what else we going to do? Because we love her so much. I'm going to personally donate some of my art.
I love you.
I'm going to donate some of my art. But y'all already know this art thing is not cheap. Y'all already know this. But I'm going to donate some art. A bunch of art. For the highest bidder. I mean, $1, $2. It don't matter. Just donate. Just donate. And if y'all hearing this show and y'all donate
$20,
$20, I will send you a print of my art.
Oh, that's
so seriously. I mean, this is how deeply I believe that we need to have her in office. I know y'all believe that too. Because y'all was asking us, like, is she really coming on the show? Not only she's on the show, she will be on the show over and over again till we get her elected. Y'all talk that crap. We need people that look like us. She look like us. And for my Boricuas, she looks Spanish too. Hey, listen.
I'm Cape Verdean. I'm Cape Verdean.
Listen. Listen. So, y'all have no excuse. Yes, we're going to bring her into the community too. Y'all already know how we're doing it.
Let's do it.
Y'all already know how we're doing it. Right? She's coming to Huntington Park so she can see what I see, right? That it's not a community of destruction. It's a community of people that care. We just don't have the resources down there, you know. But you got to donate. And donate and donate some more. Because the only way we're going to get her in office is if we support it. For the 375,000 ex-offenders in the city of Philadelphia, we always like to throw that number out. We always like to talk about we don't have equity in this. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. When it's time to vote, I need to see you out there. I don't want to see you the day after, the day before. I want to see you the day of voting out there voting for the right person. And you already know who the right person is. She's here. She's here. And if you miss it, you could go on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast and listen to this. You got my permission. You can copy it, download it, and share it. Because the message needs to get out. You know, we not playing. Y'all already know. All of y'all want to know, you know, how you getting this platform. Man, I built this platform from the bottom up. And now we up. Now we up. You want to come on the show? You want to ask her a question? We could do that too. But you have to donate. You know, I'm not going to keep bringing her on the show if you don't donate. So the next time she come on the show, I want to hear like, oh man, you know, after the show aired, yeah, some people donated.
That's amazing. Please.
Because if I don't, then you're not going to get to hear her, bro.
Well, let me tell you too, Schwab, we need us to bring us to those roles, right? Big business are not going to bring someone like me there because they think I'm going to be too busy working on behalf of us. So the people that are going to help us get to that role, and I say us, is us. If you bring someone in with the vantage point that we have to that role, they're going to be able to do things and use those resources differently than the person that came before them. So it's just a matter of understanding that we're only going to change things when we change the conversation. We're only going to change the conversation. We have people that understand how to interpret these issues from our lens.
And if you want real justice in the community, then we need an attorney general that can answer that phone when we call.
Yes.
And who is that?
Keir Bradford Gray, keirforag.com.
Say it again.
KEIRFORAG.com.
And she is for the people, not just for our people. She's for everyone. For everyone. And y'all already know where I stand at. Y'all already know. If you F up, you got to go, bro.
You get it.
You got to go. You have to go. I believe in second chances. You know, I have a nephew right now. They're serving 45 years in the state of Delaware. 45 years, no parole. Went in when he was 17. You know what I tell him every day? When he calls, because he calls me every day. I told you so. You wouldn't listen. And I love him. I love him to death. But, you know, if you F up, then you got to go. But, we here to help.
Yes.
We have resources. For those in the Philadelphia area, come down to Community College. You want to go to school? I got you for free. You can come to school for free. You want to get into a trade school? You want to get into a certification program? I got you for free.
I love that.
I give you 50%. You got to bring the other 50. But I can't do this by myself. Mm-hmm. These type of programs only assist if we have people like here up in office. They can say education. You want education? We're gonna send you to community college because they're doing it. Mm-hmm. So people,
they have connections.
Stop playing. Stop playing. If I could do it, and I have 56 IQ, I still got a 56 IQ. People,
don't you do?
No,
you
I do.
Your thing.
No, IQs don't vary.
They don't.
No, they don't.
I thought you could raise
IQ. No, they don't vary. They stay the same. Look it up. Right? So for all those they say, he would never learn how to read and write. He would never learn how to read or write. He would never get a job at a school. Not only did I work at a school, I work at the police station. That was my first job, believe it or not. Today, I go into the courts, federal and state, and work with judges.
Good.
Right? So anything is possible if we have the right people in office, people that's going to give you that opportunity. I don't care about what land you in prison. The only thing I care right now is that you home and you want to do the right thing, and I'm going to help you do it. But you got to vote. You have to vote. The same way you get on these podcasts and leave your little smart comments, do that. Do that. Do that, because if you don't, I'm going to call you out on it. And to all these community stores, all my poppy stores, they're talking about we need law and order. We need people that could listen to us. We have somebody that's listening to you right now. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? Can you donate? Will you donate? And if so, where do they got to donate at?
KEIRFORAG.com. That's KEIRFORAG.com.
And no donation is too small.
And remember, it's not K.
Or too large.
It's not K I E R. So please get this. It's K E I R F O R A G dot com. Because some people mix it up where they do K I E R. It's easy. KEIRFORAG.com. And my name is spelled K E I R.
And y'all already know what it is. Y'all listening to DBI Live. And if you heard it here first, then y'all know it's official. Please donate. Thank you.
Thank you, Suave.